Puerto Rico is moving closer to finding a new leader. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Tomorrow, Puerto Rico's governor, Ricardo Rosselló, will step down. He nominated Pedro Pierluisi Urrutia to become the next Secretary of State. We'll learn more about the Puerto Rican diaspora and their thoughts on the latest news. Also, the legendary dolphin Nick Bonacani has died in South Florida. He'll be remembered for how he took a tragedy and turned it into hope for so many. Plus, the iconic mystic and astrologer Walter Mercado loves radio.
I live in the radio sometimes. I pass from 8 in the morning to 8 at night all the time in the radio station.
There's a new exhibition at History Miami celebrating his colorful career. And finally, what is the future of the Caribbean? Artists at the PAM explore identity and that future through their work. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, Puerto Rican lawmakers are deliberating as we speak over their next governor. Governor Ricardo Rosselló is expected to step down tomorrow, and he's nominated Pedro Pierluisi Urrutia to become the next Secretary of State, who would assume the leadership role once Rosselló is out of office. But there are concerns that Pierluisi doesn't have enough votes to get the position. Well, as the position on the island continues to unfold, we start our show hearing from the Puerto Rican diaspora living here in South Florida and across the United States. Joining me in studio is former state representative Robert Asensio, representing Miami's 118th district. Representative Asensio was critical in developing the support for Boricuas following Hurricane Maria. Representative Asensio, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Also joining us is Natasha Otero, Santiago. She's on the board of directors for the National Puerto Rican Agenda, a nonprofit advocacy group focused on Puerto Rico and the diaspora community. She joins us from the NPR studios in Los Angeles. Mrs. Otero Santiago, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me, Luis. I'm really happy to be here.
Representative Asensio, I want to start with you. Do you have confidence in Pedro Pierluisi that he can win the confidence of the Puerto Rican people? I mean, what do you know about him?
Well, he has a quite extensive background in government, right? He was the resident commissioner congressperson to the U.S. Congress from Puerto Rico, represented Puerto Rico since 2009 to 2016. He ran against Rosselló, lost in the primary. Prior to that, he was Secretary of Justice, I believe. So he has years of experience. You know, it's funny because this morning I was listening to Puerto Rican radio, and there seems to be a divide, right? The people in government, the people at the government level, are saying that they do not have confidence in him. And then there's some people at the local sector, community in Puerto Rico, that say, give the guy a chance. He can be better than what we have, but we don't necessarily want him.
I mean, we had a person who was supposed to take over, and that didn't even last. She decided not to. So, I mean, Mrs. Otero Santiago, your thoughts on Pierluisi, and do you think that this is the person who can bring the island back together?
Well, I think that what's happening right now in Puerto Rico is a political struggle within the new Progressive Party. And so everybody is concerned about the contracts, the alliances that these two people, not only Pierluisi, but Tomas Rivera Chats, who is the head of the Senate in Puerto Rico, and their aim to be both want to be governor of Puerto Rico at this time. So I think that the people from Puerto Rico that march for 2 weeks to fight corruption in Puerto Rico are looking very, very closely at these two people and these two persons and what is the best of the two evils. I think that that's what's happening right now. And we know for a fact that they won't go outside the party to choose a Secretary of State.
I got to stop you right there you said the best of two evils. I mean, is this the position Puerto Rico wants to be in right now, is to choose between the best of two evils?
Well, I think that's what's happening right now is the masses have spoken. They ousted the governor of Puerto Rico because of the chats and the fraud, you know, the contracts, etc., that were being given. Having said that, these two other politicians that now aim to be governor of Puerto Rico are involved with all of this that has been happening in Puerto Rico. As we know, Pierluisi, until recently, was the lawyer under Onilio Borges of the Junta. His wife is the sister of the head of La Junta, the oversight financial board in Puerto Rico. So, and that he has interests in different contracts and things that are happening in Puerto Rico that are problematic, to say the least.
Yeah.
The same thing with Tomas Rivera Chats. This morning, El Nuevo Dia, the biggest newspaper in Puerto Rico, said that he had been given contracts to friends and families of other senators in order to make his Biden better to be governor of Puerto Rico.
So let me start with this, and I want to hear from both of you, but Mrs. Otero Santiago, I want to start with you. I mean, you developed a close-knit community of the Puerto Rican diaspora in South Florida and across the country. What are you hearing from them?
Well, we were so, for the last 2 weeks, we actually made rallies in South Florida, the same as nationally all the Puerto Ricans in diaspora. And we were very involved with what was happening in Puerto Rico and supporting the Puerto Ricans in the island. Right now, what is happening is because we are a voting bloc, not only in Florida, but nationally, we're looking very closely at what could happen, not only with the governor position, but also, and most importantly, with the oversight board. So there are people already lobbying in Washington, D.C. to see how that PROMESA law can be changed in any way, shape, or form. So what I'm listening to is, okay, so if Pierluisi, who has interests or, you know, connections to the board, if those changes are made after September, which is the date where they're putting, you know, who's going to stay on the board on this, is Carrion going is even be there now that he has a connection with the Trump campaign? Do we really have to look at Pierluisi's connections with this board if this board is going to change or the law?
Representative Asensio, your thoughts on this board. I wanted to know what you're also hearing from people here in Florida about everything that's going down.
Yeah, well, there's a mixture, right? So we do know that the board has controlled the government in Puerto Rico. Actually, I was there 2 years ago, and a budget had been I was there a year ago, a little over a year ago, and a budget was passed by the legislature. And that budget was subject to approval by La Junta. Think about that. The governing body of the island comes up with the budget, and yet a third party group that's oversight has to approve the budget. So we do know that they have created some obstacles for the island. And we also know that they've imposed some really strict requirements. Now, I'm all for accountability, fiscal accountability, right? And Puerto Rico is part of the U.S. But if the island is going to prosper economically, then I think that the Junta should do more to allow the economic development of this island and the government to self-rule, control itself, or manage its affairs, financial affairs, and then oversee that. Not restrict their budgeting, not restrict their authority, not restrict their authority given to them by the people.
We know so much of this recent issue stems from text messages that were shared, and then the anger just erupted. But I mean, this goes to issues that we saw with Hurricane Maria. And mm-hmm. if I may, you know, Representative Asensio, I'll start with you. Let's step back to May of 2017, when the island then declared a form of bankruptcy because of its debt. You know, so, I mean, we almost have to go back and say, look, this is more than just text messages. This is a mess that goes back a long ways. Is that what happened? All of it, everything just finally erupted?
Absolutely. I'm glad you took it there. Because post-Maria, I mean, let's face it, the island was decaying, eroding for decades. The infrastructure was somewhat falling apart. Now, Maria comes, it hits, it strikes. The U.S. is, there are those that say the U.S. provided immediate aid, but I was there 7 days or 5 days after the storm hit, and I saw firsthand the need that people had. People were not receiving medical supplies. People had needs for surgery. So that frustration, and then mounted, right? It continues to mount because not only did we have a good portion of people, a couple hundred thousand people that ultimately left the island, but those that are there are struggling, continues to struggling with the lack of bringing the island back online. So there are people that are still suffering from the basic needs, and that's power, utilities. Utility is fragmented there.
Mrs. Otero Santiago, you know, kind of playing off what he just said, but about this idea of, again, making sure that the leadership can have the power to determine its, you know, to handle its finances. Because, again, this is I wanted to go beyond just what's happened recently, but go back to the fact that the island had over $120 billion of debt.
Mm-hmm.
How is it handling its own finances?
Well, this is exactly this is where the problem stands. I bring it back not to May 2017, possibly to July 2016 when PROMESA was signed. And the reason PROMESA was signed just before the Obama administration ended was because of the dire need of Puerto Rico to get their finances. They had $72 billion on paper at the time. And as you said, that has ballooned with the pension plans to $120 million. We thought Rosselló, he was elected, and we thought that after Maria, just like Robert said, with the federal money that was coming into the island, there would be, a more of a fiscal matter of using this monies where it was badly needed, monies that they wouldn't have had if Hurricane Maria did not go through the island. So, as I said, you know, the evil of the Hurricane Maria came through, showed to a certain extent the federal money that was coming in, and then what it really opened up for everybody to see was how this government was misusing these funds, or how the funds were not being given by the federal government to Puerto Rico in a timely manner. So we have two things here. We have the federal money that is so badly needed in Puerto Rico, and then we have a political base in Puerto Rico that we don't know who to trust to financially, advocate, put this money where it's supposed to go, without contracts to family and friends of thousands, of hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars.
Yeah.
So this is where our problem comes. Who is the right person or the right persons to liderar, to, politically leadership that can do that for Puerto Rico?
I'm talking with Natasha Otero Santiago. She's on the board of directors for the National Puerto Rican Agenda, a nonprofit advocacy group focused on Puerto Rico and the diaspora. Also joining us is former state representative Robert Asensio, representing Miami's 118th district. As I mentioned before, Ricardo Rosselló is expected to step down tomorrow, but we're still waiting to see if there is who the next leader is going to be of Puerto Rico, mm-hmm. and what happens to Puerto Rico after this. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. Find us on social media at WLRN Sundial on Facebook or Twitter. Let us know your thoughts, especially if you're living on the mainland, what's going on back home on the island. If you're in touch with family, tell us about what you're feeling, what needs to happen next. Representative Asensio, I understand you, I want to talk about the recovery a little bit. But what's happening on the mainland? You were talking to my producers about a story of a German investor who wanted to put money into a project on the mainland and it hit a roadblock. What was that?
Yeah, well, first of all, let's go back to I want to make one point. What's going on in Puerto Rico, we're witnessing democracy at play. The people, the government of the people, right? By the people and for the people. So the people are not satisfied with the government. And yesterday there was an article that came out on Bloomberg. And it's a picture of one of the protesters holding a poster, and she's got, and it's titled bye-bye list. And on the list, they're checking off the names of the politicians, the current people in elected office, who the public does not see fit to hold, or they no longer have confidence. And on that list is Rosselló, the president of the Senate, and a list of all these people who would succeed in that succession plan, right? Democratic secession. So what has happened here is because the island has been going through turmoil with its own, managing its own affairs, the diaspora and people across the world have really come to the aid of Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. If we look back at Maria, it was a diaspora, international diaspora, that came to the aid of Puerto Rico and filled the void. So We still have that now. We have people from across the world, across the globe, that want to invest in Puerto Rico. So we have a guy, a German man, who is going to invest in business development, economic development for the island. I believe it's in the energy sector. He flew to Puerto Rico on his private jet after months of negotiating the day before the scandal broke out, the Secretary of Education being arrested by the FBI, and then followed by Rosselló's media scandal. That man, who is going to invest probably tens of millions of dollars onto the island, create an immense amount of jobs, had to leave. Couldn't leave the island quick enough because it creates a sense of distrust for the investors. I myself have been working with a group of investors here locally and industrialists who want to invest in the island anywhere from creating solar panel farms to actually manufacturing jobs. And those projects are on hold. Desperately needed jobs, sources for creating jobs, economic growth, and resilience plan.
Mrs. Otero Santiago, I mean, is it that you have investors in the island, but they're afraid of what's happening, the instability in the government, that they don't want to go near? I mean, we even saw cruise ships who didn't want to go near Puerto Rico.
No, I understand that. But we also have to be careful of who these investors are. There are a lot of people in Puerto Rico that are very concerned, and also in the diaspora, about how people are buying Puerto Rico a cent to the dollar in that sense. Are they really creating jobs? Mm-hmm. Are they really creating opportunities, economic opportunities? I believe what Robert is saying about, you know, real down-to-earth organic corporations that might be helping Puerto Rico, that's wonderful. But there are a lot of investors in Puerto Rico that really don't have Puerto Rico's best interest in mind. They just want to buy property. Mm-hmm. They want to change the laws in Puerto Rico right now regarding sunification. So we have to be really careful of who is coming to Puerto Rico and what interest they have. Actually, right now, as we speak, it's breaking news. You know, the news are going on about the Senate hearing, the House of Representative hearing. So let's hope that we can find a governor to govern us before 5 p.m. And if not, we know that the federal government will be pitching in into what they might want to do through the oversight board.
The other thing, too, is this. So Rosselló, one of the big things for him on his platform was statehood. This question had come up in the last few years. Where is that right now? The question of statehood, the idea of statehood, or is all of this pushing Puerto Rico in another direction?
Let me
start, Mrs. Otero Santiago. Let me start with you, but I want to hear from both of you.
Yeah,
what's going on?
Well, I think yes. The New Progressive Party have always they thought that they would have statehood and put it forward. Jennifer Gonzalez has been working very hard on that, as a commissioner in the United States. But more than once, the government in Washington, who makes those decisions, have said don't even think about it. So even if the Puerto Rican leadership at the moment was asking for it, it didn't mean that we were going to get it. I think that's far from the truth. I think that it's more convenient for the United States to have us as an unincorporated territory where federal laws go over any laws in Puerto Rico. That has been seen over and over again in the past 3 years of imposition of different laws because we don't have representation in the United States. And I think the people that went out into the streets to ask for the governor's outing are not thinking about Puerto Rican status. They're thinking about the best for Puerto Rico at this moment.
Right, but again,
regardless.
Look, I mean, statehood, it comes down to the federal government as to whether or not they would welcome it as a state. This has been debated for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there has always been that part of Puerto Rico, the question of independence. We actually got a question from one of our listeners, Manuel. Should Puerto Rico just disconnect, become its own entity like the Bahamas? What about the idea of independence? Is that popular at all anymore because of this? Or is that still just kind of off a fraction of the population?
Well, if I can answer quickly,
yeah, go ahead.
At this moment, it's not up to Puerto Rico to that effect. I mean, they would have to do another plebiscite, which is not coming through. Remember that the federal government has all the answers and all the hold on Puerto Rico status. So actually, Mitch McConnell or somebody in the Senate and the House could wake up tomorrow morning and decide, oh, you know what, we're going to give them independence. And that would be much more what would happen than if Puerto Ricans asked for that independence without a plebiscite. So we have to look at that.
Representative Asensio.
I agree with Natasha in the sense that, actually, bottom line, it's up to Congress to decide whether Puerto Rican, the status of Puerto Rico. And I think right now, as decades have shown us, it's more about profitable for the country, the U.S., to have us as a commonwealth. But I will tell you that that frustration adds, because many people, aside from the politicians, right, the people who are living the day-to-day struggles in Puerto Rico are asking, are we getting our fair share? And when you look at going back to Maria as an example, there was about $43 billion allocated to the island. How much has the island received? Natasha, you may be able to more up to date with that. I think it was about $6 or $7 billion that the island, or million.
I think finally received. The numbers were closer to $15 billion, and it was actually supposed to be more than $40 billion, and it has been a fraction of that.
Let me finish with this though, only because of time, real quickly. But you know, Representative Asensio, I'll start with you. The diaspora though, what are they hoping for right now? What do they want?
We want stabilization in the island. We want a government that is free of corruption. And we want those people that are responsible to be removed from office.
And Mrs. Otero Santiago, I mean, how many of the diaspora do you talk to think about going home, but they just can't?
Well, actually, they live in South Florida or in the United States, but they have gone to help during these times. I know many people that have traveled to Puerto Rico during this last 2 weeks. I am telling you, the diaspora wants the best for Puerto Rico. They showed it during Hurricane Maria. They showed it during their loving time during the Promesa Bill. And I think that now what we are trying to do is mobilize to Washington, D.C. to see what is the best resolution to the problems that Puerto Rico is having.
Again, I've been talking with Natasha Otero Santiago on the board of directors for the National Puerto Rican Agenda, and also former representative, state representative Robert Asensio of Miami's District 118. Again, talking about the change of leadership in Puerto Rico, which we are expected to hear about within the next 24 hours. Hopefully we will hear something. And of course, here at WLRN, we'll keep you informed as to what's going on. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
And again, if you're part of the Puerto Rican diaspora, share your thoughts with us. What should happen? And let us know your thoughts of the idea of statehood or independence. But what do you think is going to happen with the leadership back on the island? Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, a look back on Miami Dolphin Hall of Famer, the late Nick Bonacani. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Yesterday, Miami lost one of its most beloved sons. Nick Bonacani, former Miami Dolphin, passed away at the age of 78. He was the leader of the team back in the early 70s, especially that 72 team that went undefeated and won the Super Bowl. But Bonacani may be remembered for more for the work that he did with the Miami Project to cure paralysis. And remember, he started that group after his son was paralyzed in a football game back in 1985. And then, of course, at the end of his life, he started talking about his dementia. And he says that it's likely because of the many violent days playing this game. We're joined now by the Miami Herald columnist, Linda Robertson. Linda, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You know, Nick was in hospice care when they announced his death. But what was the first memory that came to mind when you heard the news?
You know, my first memory of Nick Bonacani was in 1972 when my family moved to Miami, Florida, and the whole place was just abuzz with this great football team, and they were on this march to be undefeated, and Nick was the leader of the no-name defense, and I just remember this sort of small, scrappy, ferocious linebacker who always seemed to anticipate the plays, where the running back was going to be before anybody else. And he was just, he was like the one of my big heroes from that team.
He had a great career. He played for the Boston Patriots, ironically, but, you know, finished his career with the Dolphins and, of course, is in the Hall of Fame. What's interesting is, you know, after he finished playing, he went into, he was in law. He worked for U.S. Tobacco. But then his son was paralyzed in a football game in 1985. What did Nick say about how that tragedy, you know, changed his life and took it in a very different direction?
Yes, he was doing very well as a, in his career. This is a guy, by the way, who got his law degree while he was playing for the Boston Patriots. And when he got the news about Mark's injury, and they told him that Mark would be paralyzed from the neck down, he would be a quadriplegic for the rest of his life, Nick recalls basically falling to his knees in tears. And he flew to Mark's bedside, and he promised his son that he would not stop until they found a cure for paralysis. And the two of them sort of became a team in this quest, and they partnered with Dr. Barth Green at the University of Miami, Jackson Memorial Hospital, to create the Miami Project, and it's raised some $500 million since they started it.
And the amazing thing again is that, I mean, he had no scientific background, no medical background, but this just happens, and it has changed so many lives. What did he say, you know, about how quickly it was able to grow and the kind of things they were able to do?
At the project?
Yeah.
Well, it basically, I mean, Barth Green gives the Bonacani family credit for basically reviving the study of neuroscience because of all the fundraising that they did. They were able to create this incredible facility at Jackson and hire, you know, the world's top researchers. They were able to do some innovative treatments. They did a lot of research and testing with stem cells, Schwann cells, a lot of innovative bioengineering progress has been made. And if you go over there, I mean, you'll just be astounded at what these patients can do now. And there's still hope that they can find a cure. They feel like they're getting closer and closer.
We're talking with the Miami Herald columnist Linda Robertson about the legacy of Nick Bonacani. The Hall of Famer and former Dolphin passed away yesterday at the age of 78. You know, in 2013, he started to show signs of dementia. And, you know, this again linked to this question of CTE and brain injuries in football. He became very vocal about this.
Yes, which was surprising because, you know, for years after Mark was paralyzed, Nick was in a sort of denial about the game of football. And both he and Mark felt that what happened was a fluke. It was because Mark played that game with a neck injury, which he shouldn't have played. You know, they blamed the Citadel for allowing him to play. And they never, you know, never blamed football. They never talked about the violence of the game and the cumulative destruction of the bodies of football players. And so I think when Nick started suffering from dementia and it became clearer and clearer that he was probably suffering from CTE, which is a neurodegenerative disease that you don't recover from, and it can only be diagnosed after you die when they examine your brain. I think he had to come to terms with, you know, the cumulative effect of this game, and also kind of he became sort of as, in some ways, as, you know, helpless as his son in terms of the difficulty he had with, you know, daily life tasks. And then, of course, his mental state declined. He couldn't remember things. He would have, you know, horrible mood swings, all the things that are associated with CTE.
And so I
think that, you know, starting this, you know, spreading the word about CTE and the dangers of football, came to him because of, you know, what was happening to him personally.
Yeah. And he had been speaking about this, you know, at Hall of Fame, at the Football Hall of Fame at ceremonies. And it was difficult for the NFL because, you know, they're celebrating the game. And yet here's this iconic player talking about how it impacted his life. Real quickly to finish up, you know, you think about everything he did for the team, but also so much of what he did outside of football. How is Nick Bonacani going to be remembered by South Florida fans?
Well, he'll be remembered as an iconic member of the only undefeated team in NFL history, the perfect season, the smallish linebacker who led the no-name defense, and he'll also be remembered for his total commitment and perseverance in trying to find a cure for paralysis and then later trying to raise awareness of CTE. And he's donated his brain to Boston University in their efforts to find a cure or preventative measures for CTE.
We've been talking with the Miami Herald's Linda Robertson about the legacy left behind by Nick Bonacani. Linda, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Again, Nick Bonacani, the Hall of Famer and former Dolphin great, passed away yesterday at the age of 78. Our condolences to his family. And, you know, we would love to hear from you. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. What will you remember most about Nick Bonacani? Well, still to come, the legendary mystic Walter Mercado has an exhibit at History Miami. We talked to him yesterday. We'll hear all about it coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Puerto Rican astrologer and psychic Walter Mercado has shaped the lives of a lot of Latinos. He's one of the most iconic and well-known figures in the Latinx community. You might know him for his fancy, mystic, and over-the-top capes, or the daily horoscope readings that he gave for years on national television. Maybe your mommy, your abuela listened to Walter Mercado every morning, waiting for his New Year's predictions. I know you've been reading those New Year's predictions every time they come out. Walter first made his mark working as an actor in telenovelas, and later in life he got a 15-minute fill-in slot where he would give out horoscope readings, which later turned to 3 decades of a long career as an astrologer. There's a new exhibition at History Miami celebrating his career. It's called Mucho Amor, 50 Years of Walter Mercado. There's iconic capes, sculptures, and more from his life. And here's a one-on-one conversation that I had with him yesterday. Tell me about how you grew up. Was it a spiritual house, a religious house? What was your childhood like?
My mother was spiritual, not religious. She believes in God. My father was loved the earth and always is planting seeds. So there is a lot of fruits in my home because my father was always planting seeds. He said that what you plant always grows if you plant with love. And he liked to talk to the plant, like a very strange thing at that time. Right now, but some spiritual person says, how beautiful that this plant, and talk to the plant. My father talked to the plant, and they're beautiful. But a pumpkin, unbelievable. And then my mother was always praying. When we are going to eat, we have to pray first and say, thank you, Father God, or thank you, Mother God, because we are having that lunch or that supper. So we are I'm very family-oriented. I adore my family. My family is the reason of my life.
At what point in your life did astrology and this, you know, being psychic, when did that become part of your life? When did it happen for you?
It never happened. The spiritual things, to be real and to be honest, have to be over from the inside to outside. Since I was very, very little, I have revelations, visions. And then the people follow me so I can touch them for good luck or for health. I touch, lady, you have a problem. Yes, I have a problem. you know, this leg, yes, and then I touch, and later on, thank you, Walter, right now I'm in perfect condition. But I'm always giving that touch of love, and they believe that that touch of love makes miracle. That's why they call me Walter of the Miracles at that time. But many years, can you imagine? And you're giving this chart, this conversation in radio, and I live in the radio. Sometimes I pass from 8 in the morning to 8 at night, all the time in the radio station, making or doing 10 soap operas. Sometimes I was the first boy of Tarzan. Tarzan is like a serial. And then I have to double to be a boy and do also Cheetah. When he's Cheetah, he's, and when I was boy, when I was a boy, he was a little boy who is traveling the jungle with Tarzan. But I have done many, many roles in my life. I work in dubbing of movies. I dub Gone with the Wind. I dub many, many movies because in Puerto Rico was the best place to make dubbing.
So, I mean, you've had so many years of performing. That's helped you in, you know, the work that you've done on your show as you know, talking to people about astrology, about their lives.
I let what I have inside, what I gave to the people who came to me. I always say, if you are full of love, you have to forget the past. The past is carrying like a burden of sometimes of guilty things and guilty and anger. Forget it. Forget about the future. God is going to plan for you. Enjoy the moment now, the beautiful moment you are living here and now. That's the only way to live. Enjoy, but in a very intense, passionate way, you are today. Every morning when I wake up late, because I'm a little, like to sleep a lot, at 10, 11, I first of all say, thank you, God. Thank you, Mother God. Thank you for one day that I'm going to live as I feel. And I'm going to give the best of myself to everybody that I find in my way through my life.
I wanted to ask you about Puerto Rico right now. The governor's about to step down, and there's nobody knows what's next, who's going to take over, what should happen.
I'm going to tell now a story. Somebody called me at the telephone. I say, when is the governor resign? And I said, the last days of July or the first days of August. It is in the radio. And yes, according to that, he left the throne in August 2, I think. But in this moment, Puerto Rico, my land, is having a cleaning. It's like it's cleaning, it's putting the things in order. There was a time that they're happening, it's not the correct people around the governor. Many persons enter in that government in order to obtain money or beneficial for him. And now they are going, the word, God, the people, demand a new government with transparency, with honesty, with the right people making the best for the people of Puerto Rico. Not even one house without the el techo, como se llama, the ceiling. Still in Portuguese, you can find houses with the green, the blue FEMA houses. No. Everything is going to change for the best. When you have one problem like this, it's like he was pregnant of negative things, and then the baby is coming out, and the baby is Puerto Rico, the new Puerto Rico, with new ideas, new demands, a new everything. Puerto Rico is in a reborn, in a beautiful country, and I love Puerto Rico. And all the Puerto Ricans are so proud of their land, no matter if those things happen, because everywhere, when there is something big coming, like a baby, there is a lot of suffering and blood, and we have been suffering a lot. But the people of Puerto Rico raise and make a lot of progress. They are looking and demanding a new Puerto Rico.
I wanted to ask you about this exhibit because it has a big collection of your stuff. And this is what you've been famous for. A big part of it is your outfits, your capes, so much of what you own. Tell us about what people, you know, the things that you shared that we'll be able to see.
This angel, Karim, began to look around to the most strange and, for me, quite important, like my first castanet, my first pack of tarot cards, my first everything. So he entered at my home, and I love him. He's a genius. And he choosing, and he makes me remember all those moments in my life when I was beginning to dance with a castanet in a stage, and when I was reading the tarot, and the people everywhere, Walter, please read what the tarot said about me. And all the things, he was taking something for the people to know that Walter is not only the cape or the hair or what they think. I have in the world, there are five persons, the most imitated ones. One is Julio Iglesias, the other Michael Jackson, but the first one is Walter Mercado. Imitation in Colombia, in Brazil, in Argentina, in Spain. They put a wig and a cape, and then, ha, paz y amor. And that, and I laugh a lot. If they enjoy it, go on doing it.
Walter Mercado, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And enjoy your time here.
Thank you. And I like that you laugh a lot, too. I expect that the people receive all that kind of vibration, that kind of energy that I'm sending to the radio station. So blessing, more blessing for all of them.
That was Walter Mercado. You could see a video of our conversation. Going to Facebook, look up WLRN Sundial and share your favorite Walter stories with us. Well, still to come, we take you to the other side of now, a new art exhibition focused on the Caribbean identity. That's up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Through massive paintings, interactive videos, and sculptures, a new exhibition at the Perez Art Museum called The Other Side of Now is exploring the future of what the Caribbean might look like. The exhibition features 14 contemporary artists from the Caribbean and its diaspora. Jamila Sabor was born in Jamaica and is now a Miami-based multidisciplinary artist, and her work uses shapes and text to explore the relationship of identity and boundaries. And she's got a couple of pieces at this exhibit, and she joins me now. Jamila, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Louis, for having me.
Great to have you. All right, the theme of the show looks at what the Caribbean could look like. For you, what does that mean?
Yeah, so it's a really amazing proposition, you know, for us to consider. You know, first I want to say how thankful I am to the curators Maria Elena Ortiz and Marcia Pierce for bringing us together to really, you know, ask this question, the notion of a Caribbean future. For me, it's something that it's so big, but the idea of rethinking or thinking about a future, for me, it's really rethinking the notion of citizenship.
You were born in Jamaica,
mm-hmm.
but you were raised here in the United States.
That's right. I was four when I came here and I grew up here.
So how much of a connection do you still have to home?
You know, it's something, it's really connected through memory. You know, I have a lot of family still there. But my, you know, growing up, my parents would always talk about, you know, everything, memories, places.
Do you think of it as home?
I do. You know, I think it's definitely the, you know, it's something that I think everyone that comes from somewhere else, like, really, really can relate to or share, this idea of straddling. You know, it's a constant straddles, you know, straddling Miami's home, but this place, this memory, you know, it's something that's shaped me. It's a longing also, you know, for this place. and I also consider it home for sure.
How did you become part of this exhibit?
So the Maria Elena, one of the curators, we had a couple of meetings last year, but just over the course of the year through conversations, she came to my studio and saw some previous works and invited me to be a part of the show.
All right. So for this, you have two pieces in
That's
this
right.
show. Let's talk about one of them. And something fascinating, too, about your work is that there's a lot of text. You have a story. You have a story to tell. And, you know, so, I mean, it's not, I never say, you know, artists, there's a traditional art. We think of art as some images that we're looking at, paint and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But art obviously stretches our way of thinking. For you, let's take a look at this one particular piece that you have. And it's called This Is Where I Was Born.
That's right.
And it, again, not the traditional painting with images and colors. You've written down something that describes you. Tell us about it.
Totally. So the piece, it's a painting comprising of text. It's oil and graphite on linen. And the text reads, I was born on a rock. Actually, it is a wide triangular ridge with a sill depth of about 4,000 feet within a space of five submarine basins separated from one another by submerged ridges and rises. I am just west of the Beata Ridge and the Avis Ridge, incomplete at its southern extremity. So this painting, something I created last year, for me, it's become a bit of a manifesto. This idea of redefining this sort of territory. You know, the piece really is an attempt to strip away concepts of nationality and exclusive geography, and to really consider the sort of infinite possibility of a place. So that the description or what I'm reading describes of geologic feature called the Nicaraguan Rise, which is a structure that's connected, and Jamaica is essentially born out of this shape. And, you know, within that shape, you know, it extends from Honduras and Nicaragua to Hispaniola. So in a sense, for me, thinking in this geologic frame, looking at the physical geography of literally the shape and the structure of this island, I'm really in a space of a kind of connected.
See, and this is fascinating because you use words to describe, to explain, to help me see this geographic shape, this idea.
Mm-hmm.
That's a challenge. What inspired this? Why go this route?
You know, for me, I think there's definitely, we're in a moment where I really do feel like we're not as connected as we should be. Mm-hmm. Just how we communicate. I do feel like there's just a desire within all of the work I do, and I'm constantly thinking about how we interact and communicate. Text has always been something, language has always been something I've been obsessed with. You know, thinking about earlier works I made, let's say in undergrad, I would cast letters and text. So it's just always been a part of my practice. But with this particular piece, it was a part of a series of works. You know, I'd made a performance earlier last year that was thinking about some of these issues. The underwater space has been a space where I'm just really obsessed with exploring. So in a sense, this particular piece was a part of a series of other works. And that.
And as you said, you like to play with language. This is interesting because Jamaica and the Caribbean in general, you have a lot of languages.
Absolutely, yeah. There are six languages spoken in the Caribbean, you know, and one of the things about this show that I really love, you know, bringing the artists together, you know, from all of these countries, you know, usually I find that a lot of these conversations are kind of categorized, or you have the Spanish speaking territories, the French speaking territories, the Anglo, the English speaking, you know, so in a sense, how do we really have a conversation about the future without rethinking, you know, is, you know, in a sense, this exploration with language, it's out of this interest, you know, is it possible to shape a universal language with all of the languages? How do we communicate, you know, with everyone not speaking the same language? It's something that I feel like it's inevitable. We have to. So, yeah, you know, another work in the show, the text is in French.
the other piece that you have.
Mm-hmm.
In this one, by the way, you have photographs of a young woman.
Yeah.
This is an important piece for you because it's personal. It's about someone in your life.
Yeah, so the other work in the show, it's another painting comprising of neon and photographs. And the text, it's in French, but it translates to say to survive something and to come back to it. And the photos, when you go see the exhibition, there are two sets of photos, and they're photos of my mother. There's a photo of her when she was 11 with her passport photo. Taken in Kingston, and the other photo on the top left is actually when she was 6, taken by her older sister. They were walking home from Sunday school, and her older sister Marjorie took a photo of her on the back of the Odeon Theater in 1964. You know, a lot of my work, my mother is definitely embedded.
Two fascinating pieces. This is an incredible exhibit. Jamila Sabura, again, you can see her work at the Perez Art Museum. The newest exhibition there is called The Other Side of Now, Exploring the Future of What the Caribbean Might Look Like. Jamila, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great, great show. By the way, we have a video up on WLRN.org where we spoke with another artist there, Sheena Rose, and you can check that out as well. Well, that's our program for this Thursday, August 1st. Coming up next week on Sundial, we have a one-on-one conversation with Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried about the new rules and regulations surrounding marijuana and hemp. Also, NPR 1A's host Joshua Johnson will be here. And he's going to be joining us for a panel discussion talking about the state of journalism and, of course, getting information. It's all about getting information. Plus, next week, we're going to have a panel discussion with teachers, and we want to hear from you. If you're a teacher, text the word TEACH to 305-602-2646, 305-602-2646. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful Friday, a great weekend. We'll talk to you next week.